Well, another Thursday has rolled around here at WFERLP in South Royalton, Vermont. And since it's Thursday and it's 11 o'clock, it is time for Green Zine. We're going to check in with some bluebirds, both melodically and informational. Back with you in just a moment. Thanks for joining us on your weekly environmental show. Combination between Corey Wong and on the mandolin, none other than Chris Thiele, with a song, an instrumental called Bluebird, here on Green Zine, Royalton Community Radio, our weekly environmental news magazine. Green Zine is brought to you today by the White River Land Collaborative. If you listen to Shelby's show, she's away for a couple weeks, but her show is on Tuesdays at 1 o'clock. Greetings from, she's a member of the White River Land Collaborative, and I'm sure they'll be getting some outdoor activities started. In fact, they've got some workshops coming up. We'll try to get information on that for you. I want to thank them for being one of our newest underwriters. They're located just across the line in Tunbridge from here in Royalton. Also, Solarfest, find out more about what they're up to. They're going to start their festival up again next summer. They're doing a lot of renovation work there on their property in Brandon. More information about them is at solarfest.org. I was just speaking with Lauren, who's the head of the First Branch Coffee Company here in South Royalton, and they are renewing their underwriting credit. We really appreciate that. Upper Pass Beer Company, their beers are available in four packs all over the place, and there are multiple taps at Carlita's Cantina that serve various recipes of Upper Pass beers. Longtime supporter of the radio station and our very first treasurer 11 years ago, Daniel Leibowitz. Royal Trailworks, thanks Tom Wells for your continuing support. Bale, they just agreed to renew their underwriting support. We really appreciate that. They're a local information storehouse. They often put on talks at their space, and you can find out more about them at balevt.org. And finally, the tracking solar company, Soliflect, based down in Norwich, Vermont. Well, if everything's working, we're going to bring up my colleague, Henry Swayze. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning. I hear you very well now.
Yeah, you're coming through loud and clear. Is it still dripping where you are? You got a little rain up there in Burlington?
It's dripping. It had our snow is just disappeared. I don't know what your snow is down there. We are definitely in the banana belt up here.
Yeah, no, the snow is hanging around, but it is melting off. Not really any major flooding or anything. It's probably the snowpack has dropped maybe a third of when it was at its peak after the storm. Probably yeah. In this area, Henry, and I don't know if you've been home, but up at your place, maybe 18 inches up there.
Yes, that's why I haven't been there.
Yeah, can't get in. Okay, you stay right where you are.
So we have exciting bunch of news. Some of it's technological, and some of it's some of it's legislative and sort of policy wonky stuff with what maybe listeners can do to help on the policy side. So maybe we should move on and cover bluebirds.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll reference the bluebirds now. Do we want to do both of those clips of the bluebird? I've got the voices and vocabulary.
Yeah, I do them back to back.
Okay, we'll do them back to back and talk a little bit about bluebird. I know our bluebird houses are up, not sure when they're coming back. And we'll also reference a little bit more of flora and fauna. I do have the spring issue of Northern Woodlands with me today. But I'm going to bring you down, Henry, and we'll go to this, Voices and Vocabularies, Eastern Bluebirds, and this is taken from Bird Note. You're listening to Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio. Well, we're going to stop that before it gets going, because I need to stop that first. We don't want two things playing at once. That's very bad form. Yeah, let's try this now.
Lovely song. The very sound of spring. A mellow, burbled refrain from the edge of a meadow. A shimmer of blue against the still wintry landscape confirms our eager hope. An eastern bluebird has just returned north. A male bluebird stands atop a wooden nest box attached to a fence post. He's an eastern bluebird, a small thrush, and he gleams deep blue with a rusty orange breast. The bluebird's song and his alert presence assert his claim to this territory. But an intruder, a tree swallow, dives toward the nest box. With a rough chatter and raised wings, the bluebird warns the swallow away. Bluebirds rely on nest boxes. In the mid-20th century, their numbers in the Northeast declined to the lowest level ever, due largely to nesting competition from non-native starlings and house sparrows. Conservation groups stepped up, setting out bluebird trails of nest boxes built just right for these beautiful birds. Eastern bluebirds have rebounded, and we can still count on them to welcome the arrival of spring. Today's show is brought to you by White Flower Farm, a family-owned mail-order nursery offering a wide range of perennials, annuals, and shrubs for spring planting. More information is at whiteflowerfarm.com. What a lovely song! The very sound of spring. A mellow, burbled refrain from the edge of a meadow. This is Bird Note. A shimmer of blue against the still
wintry landscape.
We've talked about important
bird areas many times here on Bird Note.
An eastern bluebird.
Well, Rita Schultz,
just returned
a rural mail carrier.
A mail
outside
bluebird
of Richmond,
stands,
Virginia, says every person's yard is an important bird area. Here's her story, first told in Audubon magazine.
Many customers on Rita's mail route also have newspaper delivery boxes, open at one end. When Rita discovered that eastern bluebirds were nesting in the boxes, and that many customers were throwing the nests out, she went into high gear. Rita asked all the people on her route if she could put up bluebird boxes on their property. More than half of them agreed. After Rita and a friend put up the boxes, the bluebirds needed no coaxing. They moved quickly from the old boxes to the new ones, tailor-made for them. But there have been challenges. Rita's mail route runs along the James River, home to many black snakes. Inevitably, snakes found their way into the bluebird boxes. Not a good thing for bluebirds. She won't kill a snake, mind you. Her parents raised her to respect all wildlife. So, what was her solution? Rubbing Vicks Vapor Rub on the base of the pole. Snakes, it seems, have no taste for Vicks. Rita, thank you for making life a little easier for bluebirds. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Well, thank you very much there, Michael. I would have never known that VapoRub could come in handy, Henry.
No, it's an amazing world. You just need to tune into the great world of the internet and find these things out. Some of them for real and some of them aren't.
Yep.
That one's for real one, I'd say. So I have posted on the Green Zine notes, the blue link at the bottom of the web page for the station, a very nice description of how to build bluebird boxes. And the secret is the hole size. And if you're doing a round hole, that's 1.5 inches. And you want to have the depth to the bottom of the box, 6 to 8 inches, and a bit of ventilation top and bottom to stop it from turning into an oven for them. But there's easy to follow instructions there on how to build a bluebird box. And if you have bird houses, you should clear out the old nests, because a lot of times they won't build in a nest box that has an old nest in it. True for bluebirds. And I picked these out because Jane and I were out driving, thinking we were going to be seeing ducks in the bays of Lake Champlain, which we did. But what we saw up close was enormous collections of birds alongside the road. So this was probably kind of like you are right now then down there, but it was maybe Monday of the week up here. And the snow was receding from the edge of the road, and there was leaf litter in the side of the road, and that leaf litter had birds working it. And we assumed they were starlings or something because there were such big flocks of them. But it turned out that the majority of them were robins, hundreds of robins all working in a, say, 150-foot area of the roadside.
Wow.
And then we went on further, and we were driving not along the coastline, but kind of internal on South Hero. And we saw a heron, first heron, blue heron of the season that we've seen, sitting there in a little marshy spot with quite a lot of ice around it. So I'm not sure what it was getting for a meal, but it was looking happy to be there. And then we came over a knoll, and there was a big sumac bush.
Oh, yeah. That's popular.
Edge of a field. And that had birds in it. And so we were on a lesser traveled road, and we just stopped in the middle of the road and got our binoculars out. And as soon as we started studying this sumac, we saw a bluebird, a very brightly colored blue bird with an orange chest and a bit of a white under its rump. And then within 2 or 3 minutes, we discovered that it just wasn't just one, it was two. And they were working those sumac, I don't know, flowers, seed pods. I'm not sure what you call them on sumac. But and they were brilliant. And we sat there and watched them for 5, 6, 7 minutes. And those are the first bluebirds that I've seen personally in perhaps six years or so.
Hmm.
So I was delighted to see them.
Yeah, good spot
and
there,
bluebird
Henry.
Bluebird boxes are the way to
attract those birds.
Yeah.
So, a couple more bird things, Henry, before we go to our first issue of. Hang on. Just making sure that frog jumped out of my throat. Before we move on to methane satellites, where else on the radio other than Green Zine are you going to hear about methane satellites? So question, Henry, you mentioned seeing a great blue heron. My partner and I spotted what to me looked like a small white heron, but it could have been an egret. So, and it's just down the road, down near David Ainsworth's farm. And it was kind of in a marshy place, but it was definitely pretty small, and it seemed happy like the one that you saw. What do you know? Is there such a thing as a smaller white heron, or would that have been an egret? Are they related?
It's an egret, and egrets are in the heron family. They're just all white ones.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah,
so
well,
the great blue, it's very similar in body shape.
Mm-hmm.
The white ones, I mean, the great blues have a strikingly long neck, and it's quite amazing to watch them catch and adjust food in their beak so they can just swallow it whole. And if they catch a salamander or something like that, and you are close enough with a pair of binoculars to actually watch it, you can watch that salamander travel down their throat.
Oh boy!
and they'll do it with small fish too. And a lot of the birds that will eat things that they've caught whole. And even birds that there are birds that catch wasps and bees, stinging animals, and they'll also line them up a bit before they swallow them. So with wasps and bees, they crush the bug some to get the venom squirted out of the back end. And then they line it up and swallow it.
A wealth of information. Hey, we might check in with a couple of other critters and a couple of other bugs from Northern Woodlands magazine. But I do want to. I was very fortunate this morning. It was pretty dark on my way down to the station, but out of on a fence rail, and it launched as my vehicle got closer, and it flew across our property. A large barred owl. Taking off, and where it was located made me think that there are critters, voles, moles, mice, etc., in that area. So I think he was hunting for some breakfast, and hopefully he or she had some luck. So, Henry, why don't you go ahead and introduce this piece that you've gotten from Volts for us?
Yeah, so we're going to listen to two pieces from Volts, and they both have really dramatic effects on climate change, on basically new technologies kicking in that will have an effect, and we're only going to play each one of these or a podcast, and they tend to run slightly over an hour, and David Roberts, who does it, does it usually a pretty good job of introducing what it is, kind of grand overview of what's going to be in the podcast at the beginning. And so that's kind of what we're going to pick up. And the first one's on methane satellites, and the Environmental Defense Fund was heavily involved in arranging to put up a satellite that tracks methane emissions. And the coal and oil industry have to report methane emissions for their drilling, but they do it by formula. There's a standard formula that they calculate for how much emissions might be going into the atmosphere from their drilling activity. But it turns out that when you actually go to the site and measure it, that there's all kinds of methane escaping that isn't in their formula.
Yeah.
And methane satellite is already in the sky. It's going to take a year or more to gather information before it really becomes technologically powerful. But it will have a dramatic effect on reducing methane emissions, let's listen to this this 14 minutes of the beginning of this.
All right, let's let it roll. You're listening to Green Zine, and this is from the online podcast Volts. What's the deal with these methane satellites?
Hey there, everyone. This is Volts for March 22nd, 2024. What's the deal with these methane satellites? I'm your host, David Roberts. Recent years have seen the launch of several satellites that boast the ability to detect methane emissions on the Earth's surface from near orbit. The latest and most high-profile launch took place on March 4th, MethaneSat, a project long in development at the Environmental Defense Fund, is officially circling the planet. MethaneSat has technical capabilities beyond existing satellites and represents another big step toward a future in which all greenhouse gas emissions are visible and traceable to their source. A radical change from the situation we are in today, in which the majority of emissions are estimated, not measured directly. I wrote excitedly about the use of satellite imagery for emissions tracking way back in 2019 for Vox. To get a sense of what's changed and progressed since then and what the future promises, I got in touch with Mark Brownstein, who leads the energy program at EDF. We talked about the history of the MethaneSat project, its technical capabilities, and the kinds of policies and campaigns it will enable. As a big believer in the power of transparency, I think this is one of the most exciting things going on in the climate world right now, and I was geeked to learn more about it. Okay, then, let's do this. Mark Brownstein of EDF, welcome to Volts. Thank you so much for coming.
Dave, this is a bucket list for me to be on your show, so thanks.
Well, you need a better bucket list, my friend. Okay, there's a lot to talk about here with these satellites. What's the deal with these satellites? So let me just maybe start with a little bit of history. I remember vaguely back in like the early 2010s or something, the EDF launched a big thing where they were going to do a lot of methane monitoring kind of at the neighborhood level or the ground level.
Yeah.
And then my vague understanding of that is that you guys discovered, hey, there's a lot more methane leaking than anybody thought or that anybody assumed. We need to do a lot more monitoring. And then you set off on this quest to do a satellite. So just tell us a little bit about the history of how this MethaneSat thing came about.
Dave, that's exactly right. I mean, you don't wake up one morning and go, hey, I think I'll do a satellite and put it into space. And what will I look for? Oh, I know, methane. This came out of work that we started really back in 2010. If you remember back in those days, there was, it was the early days of the fracking revolution in the United States. Industry was making all sorts of grand claims about how this was the best thing since sliced bread, and this was going to be a winner for the climate. And of course, Bob Haworth and others were, beginning to raise questions about the methane footprint associated with this gas. And our own chief scientist, Steve Hamburg, also was raising these concerns internally. But what became very clear to us early on was that no one really had a good handle on just how much emissions were coming out of these operations. Even now, to the present day, when companies report their methane pollution to the EPA, or for that matter, to the IPCC, they're using engineering calculations.
Oh, so they're not measuring their own emissions either.
No.
No one's measuring emissions directly, or was.
No one was, okay. And so there was this raging debate just exactly how much pollution was actually coming from these operations. We decided that rather than just get in the middle of the he said, she said, that we would actually go out and do field measurements. And so, back in 2011, we started with Dave Allen at the University of Texas, actually going out and doing field measurements in the U.S. That led to a whole campaign to not only look at, methane emissions from oil and gas, fields, from well sites, but compressor stations and gathering and processing facilities. We even did work looking at methane emissions associated with city gas utility systems. And what we learned and what we published back in 2019 was the conclusion that, in fact, all of these engineering estimates were woefully underreporting emissions.
Shocker.
That, in fact, emissions were 60% higher in reality than what was being reported to EPA by the industry using these engineering estimates that EPA had asked them to use, right? I mean, so this was both EPA and the industry just being way off the mark. We then subsequently went out and did similar kinds of studies in Canada. We did some in Mexico. We did some in Romania, in Eastern Europe, in Australia. Every time we've gone out and done these kinds of field studies, they always come back with the same basic finding, that actual emissions are, in fact, much higher than what's being reported. Now, that then led us to conclude that there was a need to begin to get better information at a global scale. Of course, the oil and gas industry is a global industry. The United States is the world's largest producer of oil and gas, but I think, as anyone listening to this podcast knows, oil and gas is produced around the world. It was not going to be feasible for us to be able to use the same techniques that we were using in the United States and Canada.
Right.
In other parts of the world, both because we couldn't get access to some places, and you can imagine what some of those places are, but also it'd be damn expensive and very time consuming. And so we concluded that a global challenge required a global tool. And that's where the idea of MethaneSat was born. Steve Hamburg started having conversations with a guy named Steve Wofsy up at Harvard University, who is literally the world's expert on of using satellites to assess environmental pollutants. And Dr. Wofsy told Steve, yeah, this would be possible. It's never been done before, but it is possible to do. And so they started brainstorming what this satellite could look like. And that's how MethaneSat was born.
And it's been like 6 years, they said, in development.
Yeah.
Which kind of makes me wonder, because satellites have been around for a long time, just getting something up there in orbit, you know, it's very well understood. So I'm assuming that all the difficulty in development was in the detection and measuring technology.
It's interesting because it's actually a combination of things. I mean, so first of all, even if we had had this idea 15 or 20 years ago, the technology really wasn't there at that time to be able to do this. So this is a classic example of sort of, you know, right idea at right moment.
Yeah, this was exactly my question, is what is that? What is that technology that developed to the point that we could use it? Like, what is that exactly?
It's a combination of things. I mean, first of all, the ability, 20 years ago, you couldn't enter into a commercial contract to put a satellite into space.
Right.
That's changed, right? I mean, 20 years ago, space was largely the province of, government space agencies. And as well, the basic technologies that go into building satellites, just like the technologies that have gone into, making your iPhones ever more sophisticated, it's the same dynamic at work. And as well, the improvements in computing power and computing capability also matter, because, it's not just about the satellite, right? MethaneSat is a cool piece of hardware for sure, but it has really complex and sophisticated algorithms associated with it that allow us to interpret the data that we're getting and be able to tie the emissions that we're seeing back to specific geographies and be able to do that on a relatively instantaneous and automated basis.
And Google had something to do with that, right? Like, Google's software is at work here?
Yeah, so we entered into a partnership with Google and Google Earth. If you are able to discern a concentration of methane in the atmosphere, you need to be able to tie that concentration back to a particular geography in order to be able to gain some insights as to where this came from. And then understanding also something about weather patterns and the atmosphere, be able to interpolate the impact of, the rate at which the emissions are coming out of that point. So the partnership with Google was very much about making sure that we had a good map on the ground of infrastructure to essentially correlate these emissions that we're seeing back to literally points on the map.
I feel like I'm asking a dumb question here, but how can you detect a concentration of methane in the air? Methane's invisible. I could be standing right next to a concentration in the air and I wouldn't know it. How do you see it? It's invisible, Mark.
MethaneSat, at the end of the day, MethaneSat is a spectrometer. So what that means is basically sunlight is reflected off the surface of the earth. And what you're basically doing is, and this is a, you know, this is a very sort of layperson's way of expressing this, but it's discerning the molecules of methane in that column of light. And then additionally, through the algorithms, you're essentially assessing where that concentration of methane came from, knowing something about the wind speed and atmospheric pressure and so on and so forth, and also something about the rate at which that concentration was emitted.
And could we theoretically use spectrometers? I'm sorry, I'm asking like dumb science 101 questions now, but like, could we discern other kinds of molecules in the air? Like what all can we detect with these things? Is there something special about methane in the air? Or is this the kind of thing where a spectrometer could tell you exactly the chemical composition of the air?
I'm not going to pretend like I'm the world's greatest expert on spectrometry. That's the Steve Wofsy show. And he's well worth talking to because he really does know just about everything there is to know about this. But what I've learned from him is that MethaneSat not only has the capacity to discern molecules of, you know, methane in the atmosphere, but also has the ability to discern molecules of CO2.
Yes, that was my next question.
And this is really an important point that I think, you know, a number of people have been sort of missing about this whole project, which is MethaneSat really is the first time that we will have an instrument that is capable of giving us a relatively comprehensive picture of an actual concentration of greenhouse gas pollutants coming from a major industry. And so what it signals is that we're entering a world now where for any greenhouse gas pollutant, we will start to be able to measure actual concentrations of that greenhouse gas pollutant in the atmosphere and also the actual emissions associated with, you know, individual, you know, industrial sectors. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is that everything that we have been doing and relying on for the last 30 years has been the product of emission estimates being reported to the IPCC.
Right.
Now, for CO2, that's not such a bad thing in the sense that it's relatively straightforward to calculate the CO2 emissions associated with burning fossil fuels. If you know something about the carbon content of the fuel and the efficiency with which it's burned, you can sort of come up with this. But for natural systems, for forests, for example, or for wetlands, no. And so we're on the cusp of sort of a revolution in how we understand the concentration of greenhouse gas pollutants in the atmosphere and how we can go about accurately measuring them and tying them back to sources. MethaneSat is just the beginning of a big change on the horizon.
Yeah, that's really wild. So no one is yet using satellites to detect CO2. It's all methane for now, but CO2 is on the docket.
Right. I mean, and to be fair, right, I mean, there are plenty of satellites that are measuring concentrations of, you know, CO2 in the atmosphere, but what they're not doing is they're not yet of the type that would allow you to tie those emissions back to sources, right? And that is really where MethaneSat, I think, is adding something new to the conversation, because this now becomes a tool to assess just how well the oil and gas industry is doing in managing the methane emissions associated with their operations. And that information is either going to tell a story of progress or it's going to tell a story of an industry lagging behind.
Yeah, but just to wrap up.
I wonder how that story is going to turn out, Henry.
Well, I believe that it's now been 4 days since I've listened to this podcast, but I believe that it actually goes on to say that the methane emissions from the oil and gas industries and the coal industries, mining for those things, the extraction process, that the methane emissions in the short term, which counts for a great deal with climate change, with methane being a very powerful greenhouse gas, 80 times that of CO2, if you're looking at it on a 10-year basis. And that's what we have to do for fixing climate change, is look at this short-term range. And I believe that methane may excel beyond the the carbon problem that's caused by burning that fuel. And it's a lot of it are losses that can simply be capped. They can be drastically improved. And I'm thinking that we need to alert our congressional people with the information that they should be thinking. Maybe it's the EPA. I don't know who it is, but I think we should be starting to think about how do we not just tell fossil fuel companies, hey, you've got a major leak here, and if you were to plug it, you could save $500,000 over the next 2 years. But actually say, hey, we're going to hold you accountable for these losses. We're going to add it to your bill for climate change damages or whatever.
Polluter pays. Yeah.
Polluter pays. Yeah. Yes. Get some polluter pay in here.
Yeah. You know, go ahead.
So, and just to jump on to satellites in the next layer, I was watching one of the major news networks that did a piece on a whole series of satellites, miniature satellites, satellites that are 8 by 8 by 8 inches, called CubeSats. Sats rather, and they have a solar panel on them, and this company had released perhaps 12 or 15 of them all in one go, just doop 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 doop, dropping them out like bird droppings on their way across the sky, and more launches to happen in the future. And these CubeSats are cheap to deploy because they aren't heavy. They don't take up a lot of cargo space, and they can be done by a commercial satellite launch company. And they're going to put up quite a string of those that will circle the Earth. And they have the ability to internally digest the information and figure out what they're looking at. And this string was for measuring and alerting people to new developments of wildfires. So catching a wildfire is kind of like the skybound version of the old fire towers where someone sat up there and every half hour scanned the horizon and recorded whether they saw any smoke or not rising. Yeah. And so this would allow us to get early warning of wildfires, which would be great for protecting housing and human lives and infrastructure as the climate bakes us and makes more extreme fires highly likely. So there is another just satellite technology kicking in. And the article pointed to the fact that the reason they could make this work so well is that the satellites would only report back things that they already had digested and knew were a problem. And that was because of AI, because of artificial intelligence internally to the satellites. So they weren't just sending everything they saw down. They were only sending stuff that their algorithms had taught them were important.
Okay. Wow. Well, we'll leave AI on the back shelf for now because there's a lot of different thoughts about that. But it certainly seems like it's being helpful in that application. A couple things come to mind before we go to this next piece, Henry. One is that the self-regulating part that often happens with industry in the United States has not proven itself to be very successful. And when coal was mentioned, as far as emissions go, the name that came to mind, and we have a lot of environmental villains who knew perfectly well what they were doing. ExxonMobil might be the current gold medal winner, but Don Blankenship, does that name ring a bell to you?
Oh, yes, it's.
yeah, yes, it does. It is.
I've heard that name before. Yes.
Yeah, and the last letter is a P, not a T, in his name. But it could have been changed. Blankenship, he headed up a major coal company in West Virginia, and one of their mines was the Big Branch Mine, and there was a major fire there, and a number of miners were killed, and it was shown that the warning equipment that was to be installed and be running 24/7 was conveniently being turned off most of the time, except when they needed to send in their little monthly report. And once that was discovered, I'm not sure he ever ended up spending any time in jail, but it just goes to show that, you know, having the fox mine the hen house or mine the coal mine, where they can literally fudge the numbers. I mean, as far as data, and hopefully the satellites are, you know, getting realistic data that's not being massaged by the emissions producers, that sort of more objective analysis. And then, as you said, sort of the carrot and the stick, like, hey, corporation, you can save a lot of money by capping these emission standards, and it's not that difficult to do. But if you have to spend money to do it, then you have to do it. And if you don't, that's when you bring out the stick.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think people need to be thinking. It takes a while to get a regulation or a policy or a fining system rolling. And I think with the emergence of these new technologies, we need to be having that discussion ahead of time, so that when the data that's coming from them is mature enough to use. Only a year to 2 years away, that we can make the best possible use of it and really try to reduce emissions, because we are in deep trouble in terms of climate change, and methane emissions are a big one. And some of them are things that we probably can't do anything about, like Arctic tundra releasing methane because of thawing, and that just is part of the feedback loop of of things warming up. But we sure can do a lot to fix them, the things that we have control over.
Indeed. So we've got about 18 minutes left in the show. Are listening to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio. Do we want to go to this other short piece on emissions?
Let's go to this next one, and this is a Biden administration announcement in the last 4 days with some detail. And again, it's looking at tough nuts to crack in terms of emissions, and this is an effort to roll back industrial emissions, which is really significant. In fact, I'll put this out in front because it's not part of what you're going to hear on this. And that is that the iron and steel production and the cement production each equal 8% of our global warming gases.
Wow.
And there's something else that equals 8% of our global warming gases worldwide, and that's the operation of cars and light trucks. So this is just as powerful as electrifying all the vehicles on the road around the world.
Okay, let's go back to Volts. What's the deal with Scope 3 emissions? You're listening to Green Zine.
All right. Hello, everyone. This is Volts for March 20th, 2024. What is up with Scope 3 emissions? I'm your host, David Roberts. Last week, the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, released its much-anticipated rule on disclosure of climate risks. To the great dismay of climate activists and advocates, it was substantially weakened and watered down relative to earlier drafts. One thing that fell out was the controversial requirement that companies disclose their Scope 3 greenhouse gas emissions. To those of you who have not kept up on your climate accounting terminology, a quick refresher on the scopes. If you are a business, your Scope 1 emissions are those generated on site through the combustion of fossil fuels. Think of trucks burning gas or diesel or furnaces burning natural gas. Your Scope 2 emissions are those represented by the electricity you use. You don't emit anything on site using that electricity, but greenhouse gases were emitted generating it. You are directly responsible for your Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions. Scope 3 gets into all the emissions for which you are indirectly responsible. The emissions embedded in your supply chain, your products' end-of-life disposal, and your investments. Three things about Scope 3 emissions. One, they are generally larger than Scope 1 and 2. Two, they are somewhat more difficult to measure precisely. And three, disclosing them is extremely unpopular with some powerful American business interests who seem to have browbeat the SEC out of requiring it. To discuss the history, theory, and practice of Scope 3 as a measurement metric, I went to an expert, Laura Drauker, who runs corporate decarbonization practice at Ceres, a nonprofit that works with capital market leaders and investors to encourage sustainability. We discussed where the notion came from, how the emissions are calculated, who is currently required to disclose them, and what might be next in U.S. disclosure policy. All right, then, with no further ado, Laura Drauker of Ceres, welcome to Volts. Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
This is something I've wanted to get into for a long time. So I was so glad that sort of you popped up and the news popped up and everything came together to give me a good excuse. So just to clarify, like I said in the intro, this pod is not mainly about the SEC ruling, which is interesting in its own right. It's mainly about Scope 3 emissions and why, what they are and why they're so contested.
Yeah, and I would say why they're so important, even if they're not part of the SEC rule.
Yes. We'll get into that too. So maybe the place to start then is just where did the whole scope notion, what is that? Where did it come from? How long has it been around? What's it used for? Like, why do the scope conceptual framework exist at all?
Yeah. So the scope framework really came out of, some would say, even the 1992 Rio summit.
Oh, wow. That's way back.
Yeah. When companies were starting to think about what, as an entity, what are my emissions, started talking about that. And there became a quick realization that they needed some kind of consistency in how they were talking about their entity level emissions. And so between 1992 and really kind of the early 2000s, people were talking about this. And in 1998, the World Business Council for Sustainable Development and WRI, the World Resources Institute, formed together this initiative called the Greenhouse Gas Protocol. And the goal there was really just to provide some consistency on how corporations were accounting for greenhouse gas emissions. The first standard that they produced came out in 2001, and that was where they introduced scopes 1, 2, and 3. That standard really only focused on scope 1 and 2, but they, of course, talked about scope 3 as kind of everything upstream and everything downstream from scope 1 and 2.
And was it used for anything in particular? Do you know what I mean? Like, when did it become something that companies had more than a sort of idle intellectual interest in?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, it was pretty quickly picked up. And I would say that scope 1, 2, and 3, while they're not terms that I think everyday folks know, they're terms that the business community knows very well because of this, you know, initial GHG protocol standard. These terms have been picked up by ISO standards. I think California had a system that came out right around the same time, maybe 2001, that turned into a disclosure platform in 2007 or 2008. The CDP, which doesn't stand for anything anymore, but I think it originally stand for Carbon Disclosure Project. They came out in 2000. I think they also formed.
All right, I'm going to bring that down in the mix, Henry, just over the 6 minute mark with the CDP. Yeah, interesting discussion there.
So we goofed that. That was another podcast that has happened in the last week. And that that is definitely lays the groundwork for the one I intended to play. I think we're a bit short on time, so let's not try to listen to the second one.
Oh, okay.
But the so the scope 1, 2, and 3 Securities and Exchange have to corporations are required to say what's going on because it makes the corporation vulnerable. So investors need to know what the vulnerabilities of the corporation are. That's why the Securities and Exchange Commission got involved with that.
Oh, they really want to protect those investors. Yeah.
Yeah, well, they're supposed to.
Yeah,
And they had drafts that would have done a better job, but they got rid of the scope 3.
Yes, they did.
So scope 3 is the emissions that are associated with the activity that you've done. And there many of those are the industrial, the carbon embodied in the making of steel and aluminum and cement, and it's also the disposal of products after their useful life. It is the secondary emissions that are created. So you sell someone a truck, and the manufacturer in some way is associated with all the fuel that's going to burn after the fact. And I don't know if that really falls into scope 3, but that's the feeling of scope 3. And so the industrial sector producing iron, steel, aluminum, and cement, they're the biggest ones, but there are many more. There are things like food production and so forth. All of those can be made so they don't have high carbon emissions. And that was the podcast that we were going to get into. And I'll be sure that that's up in the links for the show. And there are steel can be made without any carbon emissions.
Whoa.
Or iron and steel. And the replacement for that carbon, instead of using coal, they would use hydrogen. And if the hydrogen was being produced from green electricity, taking electricity generated by solar panels and wind and other low emissions sources like that, then that steel could be made without any carbon emissions. And similarly, cement, which produces more than its own weight in carbon emissions, and we use a lot of pounds of cement, we probably can't get rid of all of the carbon emissions, but we can reduce it. And the Biden announcement was to give a lot of these ideas money to prove that their concepts work or don't work. And so there are some steel companies that said, hey, this is a cheaper way of producing steel, so we're just going to do it, and are already in the process of moving to making green steel. And this, these, there are many ways of doing it, and the $6 million that the Biden administration has released, which is supposed to leverage another $14 million in non-governmental capital, private capital. And that's, I don't know if I said it right, that's billions, not millions. These are very big numbers. And this podcast comments that it's probably the single biggest thing that's ever been done in any administration around the world to fix climate change, and that there will be technologies to come out of this. And some of it's moving pretty fast, so it's useful in the short term as well as the long term.
And it makes for good conversation, you know, if you're at the cocktail party and you say, yeah, but what about the Scope 3 emissions? And then,
that
then you
sound
can
like a new cocktail.
Oh yeah, you're all on top of Scope 3, and the person that's listening to you has no idea, but you can find out about it all here at Green Zine. Henry, we're down to about 4 or 5 minutes, and I'm going to start some music here momentarily. But I'll just make sure we get this in. And we want to thank the folks that keep this show on the air this week, and they do include Soliflect, Bale, the Royal Trailworks with Tom Wells heading up that company, Daniel Liebwitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, and the White River Land Collaborative. And let's see, what was my number here? I'm trying to think of, oh yeah, I'm going to let that go a little bit longer. I want to bring something up that people would be very interested in. They don't have to go very far. They could hop in their EV and head over to Woodstock. Next week, in fact, a week from today, the Vermont Natural Resources Council is bringing the Wild and Scenic Film Festival to the Woodstock Town Hall over there in Woodstock. You can't miss it. It is sponsored by, well, it's sponsored by a bunch of companies. They don't necessarily need to hear from us, but I'll mention, the festival will include engaging stories about environmental stewardship, scientific inquiry, grassroots activism, outdoor recreation, and the incredible resilience of nature and our communities. It's going to be next Thursday right there at the Woodstock Town Hall right downtown. The doors open at 5:30 and the films will begin at 6:30. It sounds like it's a social event. There will be food and drink available. There's also a silent auction, which is going right now. I think your best bet for getting signed up, because they are asking you to register ahead of time, although it is a free event, is to go to the Vermont Natural Resources Council website. Easy to remember, vnrc.org. So I just want to make sure we get that in, because there's only a week to go. I am planning to be there, Henry. How about you?
Maybe.
They've got one in Burlington.
Melt going on.
Yeah, they have one in Burlington as well. There's only two sites, one in Burlington and one in Woodstock. So maybe, I'll send you the link. I'll send you the link.
Thank you.
Yeah, for sure.
And let me just say that I'm part of the 350 Vermont electricity panel that is working on trying to decarbonize our electricity, and we had a meeting with staff from all three of our Washington representatives, and it was a great meeting. And one of the things they said is that we really need to get just a few more people elected to Democrats who would be environmentally friendly to environmental regulations. And the House in particular, Becca Ballen's person, Katie, said that she spends all her time trying to hang on to the things they've already passed, and rather than having them stolen away and used for alternate funding.
And a lot of that could happen if the administration changes at the end of this year. So obviously, we need to keep an eye on that.
Excellent.
All right. So, well, good. Yeah. Keep in touch with those legislative representatives, and we'll be back next with Green Zine. Henry, I will try to find that email for the woman at Green Mountain Power about their EV plan. And if I come across it, I will send it to you. And our link, all those links that Henry is putting up are really easy to find now. The website has been redone. If you just go to our homepage and go to the bottom, you will see the links. And that includes several past episodes of our show. Right, Henry?
Yes, indeed. We're trying to each week put up the last week's show before the end of the next,
okay,
before you can't get it on replay.
Right, and this show is coming to a close now. Thanks a lot, Henry. See you next week. And stay tuned for Democracy Now! Here at WFVR-LP in South Royalton, Vermont.